Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius, John Batchelor, and I welcome Germanicus Marcovlejos to comment on what we know so far of the conflict in Ukraine, which is a wider war, says the Russian speakers, NATO versus Russia, which is an effort to maintain the sovereignty of a state, of Central European state, says NATO. And the headlines from the Telegraph tell a mixed story of what appears to be more violence. U.S. still refusing to send long-range attack missiles to Ukraine, writes the Telegraph. The U.S. reportedly has a limited stockpile and is concerned about escalation, despite pleas from Zelensky and Congress. Also, Lukashenko, the dictator of Belarus, struggling to keep Wagner troops from attacking Poland. This matches the news over these last days that Poland has ordered two combat brigades closer to the border or on the border opposite where the Wagner troops are deployed in agreement with the Kremlin after the mutiny. And we have news that Belarus' army is going to be exercising in some fashion with the Wagner groups. Then we have Russian missile strike destroys historic Odessa Cathedral. Then we have drone attack on ammunition dump halts trains in Crimea. Then we have paranoid Putin bolsters his National Guard, protect him from another coup. Germanicus, a very good evening to you. The sum total of this is more chaos from both sides. You, however, have a thought experiment for us that may inform the immediate future. Please explain. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. The thought experiment is to understand better from what we know of situations in the past, including the distant past, of what makes for defeat in a war. And one of the most critical elements that will lead to defeat is an army breaking. Because when armies break, wars end. And here we don't mean individual armies, as you would find in antiquity, that are wiped out, in large part because a tough nation or city-state will reform and gather up its men and create a new army, as Rome did after the terrible Battle of Cannae in 216 B.C., and this is true, too, even in more modern times when you had wars ended by a single battle, as Napoleon did in the war against the, Third Coalition, when he defeated in the Battle of the Three Emperors the Russian and Austrian armies at Austerlitz, basically destroying them. That led to a temporary peace, but of course, the Austrians and the Russians reformed. They got bigger armies. They began to do better slowly against Napoleon. So the fact is that destroying a single army in a war is not necessarily decisive. But if you take army as the measurement or yardstick for the whole military enterprise of a nation, in other words, that which gives a nation the ability to make war, meaning its armed forces, and the armed forces break, then the nation can no longer move ahead in its fight. In other words, when the army breaks, its soldiers essentially collectively decide they're just not going to fight anymore. They refuse battle. And the big question is, given the fact that this has happened many times, including most notably in World War I, which I'll address in a second, how does a nation get to a place where its fighters collectively refuse to go on, refuse to fight? And I think this is the actual question that needs to be addressed about Ukraine today. And part of what breaks is the result of attrition. And I think attrition is noted in terms of losses and casualties, but it is not fully understood, especially by people who are, shall we say, politely, not wise to the ways of war. Attrition isn't simply casualties. It's also the tremendous trauma that goes hand in hand with death in battle. And that trauma is extended to those who survive battle, who aren't killed, and it wears away at them. And armies that are engaged in day after day campaigning and month after month endless battles begin to have their psychic energies worn down, as well as the physical losses that they endure. And those energies, which we can express as ardor and hope, ardor is the energy, the bloodlust to go into battle, the eagerness to fight, to risk one's life. And hope is the conviction that motivates you to continue going into battle because of your belief that victory is certain. Now, those are seeping out in attrition, and the longer the attrition continues, the less and less you have of the essential ardor and hope that keeps an army going. And it's really interesting as a benchmark to look at the attrition that was sustained by the Confederacy, the Confederate States of America, and its army during the Civil War. And unknown, I think, to most of us, the Confederacy had only a million or so men serving in its army, and 350,000 of them, according to the latest and really interesting work that has been done on trying to understand what the actual number of deaths might have been, has come to a figure of 350,000. And then that includes a couple hundred thousand wounded. Amazing, because more men were dying than survived as wounded soldiers, which is part of the horror of war in the mid-19th century. But that is over half, or about half at least, of the total number of men who served and who fought. And yet, at the end of the war, as we can see, Lee had to surrender. The army was still unbroken, what was left of the army, but it was still unbroken. And that is not what we see in more modern times. In World War I, you know, from 14 to 18, that's 4 years, six out of seven of the armies of the main great powers who were fighting broke down. In other words, they couldn't do it anymore. That led in the sort of best case situation to mutinies, mostly in the French and Italian armies, which could be quelled and the army could be put back together. But in the others, when they finally broke down in Austria-Hungary, Germany, and the Ottoman Empire, and of course Russia, they led to surrenders en masse and then ultimately revolutions. And the battle losses never approached that of the Confederacy, which was 5.4% of the total population, white population of the South, of course. Germany lost a little more than 3% of its population, and France lost 3.6% of its population. And yet their armies were brought actually to the edge. And it's funny because these breakdowns occurred after 4 years of war and after terrible losses. I mean, in the first day of the Somme, the British Army took 60,000 casualties, dead and wounded, in a single day. And then Italy, after the Battle of Caporetto, in 17 days, lost 300,000. And the only reason Italy could keep going was the French and British rushed 11 of their divisions to Italy to prop it up. So World War I shows a situation where enormous losses aren't enough to break an army. However, the commitment of the army to fight, even if it's been terribly attrited, it's lost much of its ardor and much of its hope, it will still keep fighting, if not very well. But it will be brought to the point of failure and breakage when three things happen. And they are, first of all, the war that begins full of high hopes suddenly is seen as unwinnable. Early victories are now old memories. More battles are lost than won. The costs of battle keep rising. And they keep rising and keep rising, even if you think you cannot endure it anymore or any more intensity. It still keeps rising. This is clearly what is happening to Ukraine. Second, external support from friends and allies just begins to wither away. Now, this is a super negative factor. If the support of friends and allies and the world is the emotional foundation of the army's belief in ultimate victory. And again, this is absolutely the case with Ukraine. It's been promised by much of the world, at least the West. It's been promised endless aid, and it's been promised eventual ultimate victory. The third is the moment of breakage, which comes with the moment when the army begins to think that those who initiated the war, who promised a road paved with victory, vowed the world would support that army until victory was won, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, suddenly they begin to look at their leaders and see them as liars and deceivers. They feel betrayed by the men who lead them. Again, this is clearly beginning to happen with Ukraine in the sense that you have increasing evidence of denunciations by unit officers, denunciations not simply of the top leadership, but of their immediate superiors who they feel have been using them and leading them into, you know, what are called meat grinder battles, where they're being used as cannon fodder simply to show the West that, oh, look, we're fighting. And the result is that you have a situation that I believe could be approaching what Hemingway called a situation when asked, how do you go bankrupt? And he said, or wrote, gradually, then suddenly. And this is exactly what happened to the fallen empires at the end of World War I. So Germany, Austria, Hungary, Russia, and the Ottomans, after grueling battles, after losing so many men over 4 years, things just happened fast in the early autumn of 1918. And this is of note because Ukraine, now remember, I had said that France had lost 3.6% of its population, Germany, 3.1% of its population in the war. In a third of the time it took to bring the great powers, the empires to their knees in World War I, in a third of that time, a mere 500 plus days, Ukraine has arguably lost 2.5% of its population. Now, here I'm comparing Ukrainian irreplaceable losses to killed inaction losses and other killed by the powers in World War I. And I think that's more germane because irreplaceable losses are exactly that. This was a term coined by Soviet historians of the Great Patriotic War. And it means all of the dead, the crippled who can never return to the ranks, the missing and the captured. And so this is, I think, the benchmark we need to look at for Ukraine.
Detail the consistent formula of asking for more weapons or more powerful weapons being denied, and then months go by and they're provided. Has that helped or drained the confidence of the Ukrainian army?
The Vilnius summit, which we addressed in discussions, conversations in the last couple of weeks, I think was an eye-opener for Ukraine, and especially the army of Ukraine, the collective citizenry in arms in Ukraine. Because what they saw at the Vilnius summit, which was just revealed by a Wall Street Journal article, is that the West, that is to say, NATO and the United States, knew full well that they were not giving Ukraine enough weapons for them to win even modest tactical victories or successes. And we went ahead and pushed them anyway to unleash their offensive. And we hoped, as the French hoped in 1914, by the way, the French had this concept of élan vital, of the furia francese, that French bodies would overcome German guns. They really believed that in 1914. And they lost 250,000 men in the first 3 to 4 weeks of war in 1914. Ukraine has been urged by NATO to do the same thing, with the hope that somehow their élan vital would overcome Russian mines, Russian guns, Russian drones and lancets and artillery. And so Ukrainians today in the army are increasingly restive. They know not only that NATO was using them and they would never get to be part of NATO, and now they're feeling that they're being used by their superior officers and the national leadership, who are making millions, if not billions, off of the U.S. The New York Times admitted that over 30% of all the weapons we've sent to Ukraine have been filched and sold on the black market, sent out from Ukraine ports to the whole world for billions of dollars. The billions that we're spending to provide pension relief for Ukrainians, how much of that has been sidelined and sequestered for the machers who run the state today, not just the oligarchs, but people like their own leader, Mr. Zelensky? How much has he made? Some people claim that he's already a billionaire. This is a situation that is ripe for disaster. One of the things that happened to Italy in World War I, as a result for the flagrant sacrifice of Italians for nothing, for example, in the 12 battles of the Isonzo, throwing hundreds of thousands of Italians against mountains filled with Austrian machine guns, the Italian state essentially collapsed after the war. Why do you think Mussolini was able to make his march on Rome? The Italian ruling class and their establishment collapsed because of the sacrifice in the war that was made for nothing in the estimation of those men who served in the army. And I think this is very close to where Ukraine is going. And we have to remember that when we reckon Ukrainian casualties, and the percentage that I've cited of almost or more than, who knows, 500,000 irreplaceable casualties, when I say those casualties are 2.5% of Ukraine's population, I'm talking about the actual Ukrainian population in Ukraine, which is about 20 million. And I've talked about this before and gone through all of the data that not only suggests, but that highlights that this is in fact true. Ukraine is a shrunken country. And for a country that's smaller than Taiwan and only a little bit bigger than the Netherlands, to have lost 500,000 in irreducible casualties is a crime, in the sense that morally and ethically, the West, NATO, the U.S. has suborned Ukraine to fight a war not only that it cannot win, but that will destroy Ukraine in and of itself, no matter how much territory it possesses at the end of the war. It has been, as John Mearsheimer puts it, wrecked. And this is, in effect, a crime of statesmanship. And it is already accomplished. We've destroyed Ukraine's future. And I have to say, if their losses continue for much longer, before the army breaks finally and reaches the level of what France suffered in World War I, remember, France was a nation of 39 million people in 1914. In 1940, it was a nation of 39 million. Ukraine is not as well positioned for the future as France was after the end of World War I. So take that on board. In other words, France did not grow for 25 years. Ukraine will continue to shrink. Its best people have left. They're in the EU, or they're in Russia, or they're in the territories taken by Russia. And what's left of Ukraine is very old, and it is a shrinking proposition. This is a terrible thing to have done. And so the exploitation of Ukraine by the West will undercut the West's reputation and its capacity to act with authority at any time in the future.
Germanicus is Marco Vlejos. We're in Londinium. It's a beautiful summer's evening. The Thames is quiet for the moment. The bridge is intact and no disturbance. There was a turbulent water these last weeks. The retired centurions and their families are shopping happily in the evening. And we're reflecting on events in the 21st century. We turn now to discussing a new book. It is by the distinguished historian Serhii Plokhii, a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University, a man of great scholarship and very careful prose. What the book reveals is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's thinking about Ukraine before his death, in his last essay published in 1998 about this matter, and what Vladimir Putin makes of that essay, and what the understanding is in Moscow of the war in Ukraine. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I am Gaius. Michael Vlejos is Germanicus. Thank you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.